Well, thank you, man. I appreciate that. I call your attention to the Old Testament. We're back in Samuel tonight, 1 Samuel 22. 2 weeks ago, we kicked off this chapter, and I spoke on the first two verses. I began the chapter by simply saying that we see David running. He's running for his life, and he is living in the caves of Adullam. In our Bible, it talks about the cave, but in the Hebrew, it's caves, plural. Evidently, it was a large, cavernous area that was deep in the earth, in some limestone area of Judah, and so he was there in those caves. That's where he wrote a couple of the Psalms. And then the Bible says that his family and all of his father's house, they heard that he was there and they came down. And so his loved ones came and they began to basically live with him. And I guess the reason that they probably felt the need to do that is that the Philistines had begun to overrun Bethlehem. And also the fact that Saul was seeking David, and if they couldn't find David, then perhaps he would begin to take his wrath out upon the rest of David's family. I don't think that if we have looked at the life of Saul for any length of time that we could come to a different conclusion than that was a distinct possibility. He absolutely hated David. He despised things about David, even though David had done nothing to deserve the scorn, to deserve the abuse, deserve the attempts on his life. But yet, you have Saul, and he's going after David with everything that's within his power. And so his family probably thinking, you know, we've got to at least go be with David, not to offer him protection, but probably just to try to think, well, maybe we can prolong our lives by being with our son. And then the last group that we saw, which was in verse number 2, we see that people that were in debt, people that were in distress, people that were having just a hard time making it under the pressures that the government was placing upon them. And so you had a bunch of losers that came, and they began to live with David, and they began to follow David. And David had to take this ragtag bunch of about 400 people, and he began to try to organize them into some semblance of an organization that could be, I guess, led. Later on, there'll be another couple of hundred that will come and be with him. But tonight, we're going to pick up in verse number 3. And before I get too far, let me remind the deacons that we have a meeting tonight after the service. Trustees met before the service. The deacons will meet with me after the service tonight. And so if I forget to mention that at the end, I've mentioned it now. And so look with me at verse number 3. And David went thence to Mizpah of Moab. Keep that in mind, because this is a different place than you find with Jacob and Laban over in Genesis 31. This is in the area of Moab, which is, I believe, it's east of the Dead Sea. And so he said unto the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with thee till I know what God will do for me. And he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in the hold. And the prophet Gad said unto David, abide not in the hold. Depart and get thee into the land of Judah. Then David departed and came into the forest of Herith. The first thing that I want you to think of tonight is I want you to think about David providing for his mom and dad. In verse number 3 and verse number 4, we see that he wants to protect his parents and to provide for his parents. Let me just mention two or three things as we go through verse number 3 and verse number 4. And then I'm going to make a few comments about caring for our elderly parents. And so I want you to look with me beginning at verse number 3. The word mizpah means watchtower. So evidently in the land of Moab, and by the way, the Moabites were a group of people that were distant relatives to the Hebrews. You have Abraham and Lot way back, many centuries before David. And what do you have? You have Lot, and he's living in a place called Sodom. And Lot is told by the angel of God, you get out, you take everybody with you, and the only ones that he could get out, his wife and two daughters that were unmarried. Well, you know the story about how that the angel said, when you leave, don't you look back. And so when they left, probably because she had children that were there, she may have had grandkids that were there, she turned, Lot's wife did, looked back, and when she did that, she immediately turned into a pillar of salt. Well, the two girls did not look back, nor did Lot look back. It may have been better had they looked back, because it wasn't long before they were living in a cave. And the girls began to talk to one another, and they said, you know, we're never going to have a husband. We're never going to have children. You know what we've got to do? We've got to take matters into our own hands. And I tell you what let's do. Let's get Dad drunk. And when he's drunk, the oldest one said, I'll go in and I'll lie with him. And that's exactly what she did. She conceived a child, and from that offspring, the group of people that we know as the Moabites began. The second daughter did the same thing, and that group created, or that child created, a group of people called the Ammonites. And you've got Moab and Ammon, and they really are at odds with God's people since that time forward. Maybe they felt slighted. I just know this. I know that Saul was at war with the Moabites at this very moment. You say, how do you know that? Hold your place here in our passage, and I want you to flip back to 1 Samuel, same book, chapter 14. 1 Samuel, chapter 14. In chapter 14, if you'll look with me at verse 47. And Saul took the kingdom of Israel, or took the kingdom over Israel, and fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the children of Ammon. Those are those two groups of people from those incestuous relationships, against the people of Edom, and against the kings of Zorbah, and against the Philistines. And whithersoever he turned himself, he vexed them, or he fought with them. Now go back to our passage over in chapter 22. And so we see that David has left a cave. He's been in Adullam. He's now going to a watchtower. Evidently it was an elevated place in the land of Moab. And he begins to in his mind think, I've got to get them out of Judah to protect them. And so he begins to rationalize, who can I go to? How can I get this thing taken care of? And so he begins to light up on a plan, and he says, I'll go to Moab. Now, we just read a passage out of chapter 14 where that we see that Saul is at war with these people. Why would David choose to go to the enemy of Saul, which was the enemy of the Israelites? Why would David choose to do that? Well, I think that most of, what we would probably come up with would be some type of speculation, even though I think one thing is probably the reason. And I'll give those to you in just a second. First thing is this. Have you ever heard the old adage, the enemy of my enemy is my friend? You hear that often in politics. If you follow politics at all, you have certain countries and they seem to be aligned with someone, and the whole alignment that they have made with each other is because they both don't like this person. And so it could be the fact that the Moabites didn't like the fact that Saul was constantly warring with them. They thought, well, maybe David will not be that way. I mean, the fight was with Saul, not with David. David had not done anything to the Moabites that I remember reading thus far in the 21 chapters that have preceded us. He's fought the Philistines on numerous occasions. But what you've got is, you've got David, and he's just probably thinking, well, if they hate Saul that much, maybe they will give us maybe at least a little comfort. I mean, after all, maybe they won't be as threatened in Moab as they are right now in Judah. The second reason, and I think probably is the more realistic one, if not both of them would maybe possibly be true, but I certainly think that this second one has a ring to it that just kind of makes sense to me. I want you to think back about the family lineage of David. If you think back, who was David's great grandmother? We wouldn't know anything about this except for the little book that precedes 1 Samuel. I want you to hold your place in our chapter, and I want you to go back to the book of Ruth. It's the little book just before Samuel. As a matter of fact, in the Hebrew Bible, Judges and Ruth are put together on the same scroll. In our Bible, they are divided. It's easier for us to find it that way. So I want you to go to the book of Ruth, chapter 4, and I want you to look with me at verse 17. And the women, her neighbors, that is Naomi's neighbors, gave it a name, saying, "There is a son born to Naomi." Now, in reality, Naomi did not give birth to this child. Naomi was not even blood to this child. But she was the grandmother. I preached one time a message out of this passage, and it was on a Wednesday night, and it was called Grandma Naomi. And after I got finished preaching about how that this lady's life, the first 3.5 chapters of this book, Naomi is just one sad lady. Her husband's dead. Both of her boys are dead. One of her daughter-in-laws goes back to Moab. But Ruth, she loves her mother-in-law. And she goes back to Israel. And they begin to just try to live the best they can. And the next thing you know, Ruth is out there gleaning from the edges of the fields in the fields of a man named Boaz. And I preached about how that Ruth caught Boaz's eye, and who is this? And well, this is the daughter of Naomi. This is the daughter-in-law, and she came back with her when she returned. And he begins to tell the workers, leave a little extra handful on purpose. That's where that phrase comes from. And so you've got Naomi that is now blessed with a grandson from Ruth and her marriage to Boaz. But then I want you to look with me at the latter part as it gives a little genealogy here. You got this little boy named Obed. And Obed grows up, and he's got a boy named Jesse. And Jesse grows up, and he has a bunch of boys. The last one is named David. And so you've got a lineage that's there, and he's thinking, maybe they will remember my great-grandma. She was a Moabitess. Maybe my great-great-aunt, Orpha, maybe she's told the stories about what happened with Ruth and what happened, how that God just seemed to bless Ruth the Moabitess. And so David maybe thought, I can go back and maybe that family lineage maybe still is in the mind of those people as they would pass it on from generation to generation. Well, evidently, it seems that that's probably what happened. Now, if you go back to chapter 22, let me share with you a couple of words that I want you to pay real close attention to. He says to the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, I pray, come forth. There's a lot of commentaries that talk about those two words, come forth. And when we think of it, we think, well, they just let them step forward. But the way that they describe this, David is literally asking the king of Moab, let my folks come for a visit. Doesn't that sound like when people go see relatives? You know, it's one of those things where that you say, well, where are you going to go? Well, we're going home. We're going to go see grandma. You know, and sometimes years ago, people would stay a long time. My wife tells the story about her grandmother, her dad's mom, and how that every summer she would come and stay a minimum of 8 weeks in the summer. And all I'm thinking is, that would be rough. 8 weeks? You know, I mean, I like to live by the old Scottish proverb, after 3 days you hand them a shovel. You know? And so you've got David saying, let them come for a visit. Let them begin to try to find folks from the past. Let them just hear the stories. And in reality, what David is doing is he's trying to protect his folks. He knows that if he's on the lam, he can't do that. He knows that if he's running, they're elderly. They can't run literally like they used to. How many of you that are 60 years old or better have ever had this thought? You know, I think I could run 50 yards. I mean, I used to do it a long time ago. I remember one day about 2 years ago, I decided that I was going to come over to the gym and I was just going to shoot basketball for about 30 minutes. I went through all the basketballs that we've gotten. By the way, we need some new basketballs. Those things are slick. I don't know how anybody grips one of them. I finally found one, found a pump, pumped it up a little bit. I bounced that thing around a little bit, and I used to be a decent basketball player. I bounced that thing back and forth a little bit, and I thought, nothing but net here. Boom, and I shot that thing, and it was nothing but air. I mean, I didn't even hit the backboard. It was terrible. And so I thought, I'll run that ball down and I'll just run around a little bit out of here. After about chasing about three balls, I thought, you know, my enthusiasm for this exercise is over. I put that basketball back in the closet and I don't think I've picked up one in a while. But you think about when you're elderly, you don't do things the way that you used to. Now, in your mind, you think you still can. But when you start trying, all of a sudden, it ain't necessarily so. And so you've got David realizing that his parents are aged now. I have no idea how old they are, but my guess is he's the baby boy. He's in his 20s now. My guess is they've got to be well into their mid-60s, easily. And so he's trying to find protection for them. Which brings me to this. How should we treat elderly parents? David is under pressure. I mean, there'd be some people, and if he just kind of left them in the cave of Adullam, very few people would have said, yeah, well, probably that was probably a good place of protection for them. And there would be a lot of people that would justify that, but you don't find David doing that. You find him taking them and putting them under the care of somebody that can help them. And so, how are we supposed to treat our elderly parents, no matter the circumstances that we find ourselves in? First of all, I think we're to honor them. The Bible says, honor thy father and thy mother. I heard about a professor in a college, and he did an experiment at the first of every year. He would get all the incoming freshmen together, and he would say, I want you to start your own nation. And I want you to give me 10 or 11 things that you would build your nation and its society upon. And he said it was very, very rare that you would ever have anybody that would say anything about taking care of parents and the aged. And he would begin to talk to them about it, and he would say, do you realize that God gave Israel 10 commands? The first four commands have to do with our relationship with God himself. The final six of the commandments have to do with man's relationship with man. The first of the final six has to do with honoring your parents. How many people would have put that in your top 10? Not many, but God did. And so you honor them. You give them a prominent place. Why? Because we're commanded to do that. We are told by God to do that. And so we give them honor. Not only do we give them honor, but we're to give them respect. One of the things that is a foundation stone of Christians is supposed to be the sanctity of life. We don't take the disabled and the elderly and the infirmed and send them out in the forest somewhere just to die. That's what pagans did. Christians didn't do things like that. You didn't take people that could no longer fend for themselves and call it humane by just letting them die off. We are to respect those parents that gave us life. Not only that, but I believe that we are to give them provision when it's needed. The Bible tells us in 1 Timothy chapter 5 in verse 8. Now, in most times when this verse is preached, it's talking about people taking care of their children. And I've known of preachers, and I've preached sermons about this, that if you're a parent and you don't take care of your kids, you're useless. But I believe this. If you look at it, it doesn't say children in the context. It says that if any provide not for those of his own house. So whether it's those that come after you or those that came before you, it says that if you have not provided for those of your own house, you have denied the faith and are worse than an infidel. David didn't do that. David sought to honor Jesse and his wife. David sought to give them a place where they could be protected and they could be provided for. He went to the king and he said, give my folks a place. He wanted to give them a place of respect. I can't help but think that the king of Moab may have been impressed by this. And so he was trying to provide for his own household. Well, What should providing for our elderly parents, what should it consist of? Well, may I say that care should not be based on their worthiness? Now let that sink in for a moment. There are some parents that have treated their children horribly. There are some parents, and I mean they cause nothing but grief to those children. And I've known of situations where those kids didn't have anything to do with those parents when they got old enough to leave home. I'm thinking about a family right now. There was a boy and there was a girl in that family. And when the husband would get home, the mother had already beaten those kids. I'm talking about with a belt with the buckle. They would be bruised. They would be bleeding on some occasions. And her husband would look at the wife and say, "That's enough, no more." And a day or two later, it was the same thing. And the father died. And the girl came to the father's funeral. And the boy was there as well. And this lady told the preacher, said, "I won't be back for the next one. I won't be back for the next one." So when the mother dies, the girl said, "I won't be coming back for that one." But can I say that care should not be based on unworthiness? Because when you read the scripture, it doesn't give us a qualification. Honor your parents if. There's no if there. You ought to do the best you can to try to honor and respect them, even when it's tough. Number two, care may be hard, but it'll bring blessings to you. I cannot tell you the number of times I've had counseling sessions where someone would say, "Boy, preacher, I feel bad that I did this. I mean, if I wouldn't have quit, if I would have just hung in there a little bit longer, I don't think that my conscience would be on me like it is." Oh, but there's been other times when I've known of people that have taken care of their elderly parents. And I mean, they have gone the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth mile. And then when the parent dies, they say, "Maybe I should have done a little bit more." And I look at them and say, "You did everything that you could do. You have no reason for guilt. From what I've seen, you did right by them." And I'm going to tell you something. If you do right by them, even if it's hard, after they leave here, you'll be able to look in that mirror and say, "I'm okay." And I'm going to tell you something. The closer you are to God, the more tender your conscience is. And I want to be able to look in a mirror and I want to be able to say, "You did what you were supposed to do." Not only that, but I believe that neglect brings the judgment of God. Look with me at Proverbs 26. Proverbs 26. Now I want you to look with me at verse number 27, I believe it is. "Whoso diggeth the pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it will return unto him." If you don't take care of elderly parents, and you've got the ability to and the resources to, get ready, because when your time comes, you're going to reap what you've sown. You better do everything that you can if you want that kind of care when you get there. One of the things that has blessed my heart so much by some of the people in this church is the way that spouses have cared for loved ones, their husband or their wife, their mom or their dad, and how that on a daily basis, even when they no longer could physically take care of them and they had to put them in a facility that helped, every single day they go by and they make sure that they've been fed. They make sure that they've been taken care of physically. I don't want to embarrass them, but when Brother Bob and Miss Charlotte, when Bob's mom and dad were in two different locations, every single day of the world, they went from one to the other and back. I'm talking about 7 days a week, and we're talking about 2.5 or 3 hours between the facilities. That's honoring. That's respect. That's the way that God intended it. And I guarantee you, at night, when old Brother Bob and Miss Charlotte lay their head on their pillows, they ain't got to worry about, I should have done more, because they did everything they could do. I've only got one parent left. I got a mama. Right now, she's doing pretty good. But there may come a time when I have to bring her to live with me. And I've already offered that, and she's like, no way. My sister's offered it, and she's like, I'm not moving in with her. I want to be in my own house. But there could come a time when I've got to do that. And if I'm the son I ought to be, I've got to do what I'm supposed to do. And so David is caring for his aged parents. Well, let me give you one final thought tonight. Look at verse 5. Well, let me go back to verse 4. I do want to comment on this. So he brought him before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him, the king, all the while that David was in the hold. All right? Now I want you to pay real close attention. The cave of Adullam is a place for him to be, but he's left there. The hold in verse number 4 is a word in the Hebrew, and the word that we use today is a place that's right close to the Dead Sea, and you've heard me reference this on a few occasions. It's a place called Masada. Masada is 1,200 feet high. Now remember, Masada was where the Romans, and I think it was about 69 AD. Masada was where in about 71 or 72 AD. That was the last stronghold. And the Romans built that ramp, and that's how they got to the top of that thing. But you go back in time 1,000 years before that. It's just a rocky face. And the only way that you get up into those crevices, 1,000 years before King Herod built that palace on top of that place, the only way that you got to the top was with the snake path. And it's a winding path that only two people could walk side by side. And that's why it was such a strategic place, because you could have water that would be brought in through aqueducts, and there was great protection there. They could grow food on the top of the place, and you've got a two-person path, and you've got these folks up top, and they're just knocking them off with rocks. They're throwing fire on top of them. They're shooting down at them from a strategic high point. And David goes to the hold of Masada. And so we come to verse 5. I want you to see that there's a prophet that he listens to. So he took care of his parents, and now there's a prophet that he's listening to. David now has a prophet that's in his merry band of misfits. It won't be too long before there'll be a priest that's going to come along and join that merry band. But right now, one of the three prophets that is in David's life during his whole life is introduced to us. His name is Gad. The other two prophets have been Samuel, and there'll be an old prophet that'll put his bony finger in old David's face, and he'll say, "Thou art the man." His name is Nathan. And so you've got Gad, the prophet, and he said to David, "Abide not in the hold. Don't you stay in that stronghold of Masada anymore. You depart and get thee into the land of Judah." So he's in Moab. Now he says, you get back into Judah. You've left your parents. They're being taken care of. So don't go to Masada now. You go back to Judah. And so David listens to the man of God. He departs, and he came into the forest of Hereth. The forest of Hereth is a mountainous hillside, a hill range, so to speak. It's many miles in length, and there's trees everywhere. I guess if I were going to give us an analogy that you could readily pick up on, think about Robin Hood and Sherwood Forest. All right? And so you've got David that is now living in the forest with his people. You got 400 people minus his family that he's dropped off. But now he's turning them into a fighting machine. He's beginning to train them how to be warriors. And so he is in the forest. Now, I don't want to get too far myself, because next week I'm going to be picking up in verse number 6. And let me just kind of whet your appetite a little bit, or tease you a little bit. Saul is looking for David. Look with me at verse 6. "And Saul heard that David was discovered." He was found. Now, where is Saul at this time? He's sitting under a tree with his spear in his hand. Now, what do you think he's thinking about? I mean, he's got spies looking for David. He's thinking, when I find out where he's at, he's dead. He's dead. But can I say this? Saul is always 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps behind David. Because you see, when God directs our paths, it's always going to be to the safe place, ultimately. Doesn't mean we're not going to have some problems. But what it tells me is, it tells me this. It tells me that if we let God direct our pathway, no matter what trouble the devil's trying to get us in, no matter what attacks he brings our way, it'll all be for naught unless God allows it. Now, I want you to look with me, and where does he discover that David is at? Well, do you remember 3 or 4 weeks ago when I talked about how that David had gone and he met with the priest Abimelech? Or Ahimelech, and he got the showbread that was 8 days old, and he gave it to some of his men so they would have something to eat. There was a vile man there named Doeg. We'll get to him a little bit next week. He's a spy. And he goes and tells Saul he was by Ahimelech. Now, I want you to think with me a moment. How many places has David been since he was at Nob with Ahimelech? How many places? Well, first of all, After he left Ahimelech, where did he go? He went to the Philistine city of Gath. You remember the king of Gath was a man named Achish? And what did David do? He's there in that Philistine city, and he's feigning madness. He's making like that he's crazy, like he's insane. I mean, he is letting saliva run out of his mouth. He's scratching on the gates of the city. And so Saul hears that he's in Nob with Ahimelech. But no, he's been gone from there for a while. And he's gone to Gath. But not only that, after he left there, he went to the cave of Adullam. We found him last week. And where's he at? He's in that underground cavernous area. And 400 people are living underground with him. And so he has already gone from Nob to Gath to Adullam. But then he moves from Adullam to Moab, or to Mizpah, probably the capital of Moab. So Saul thinks he's in Nob, but he's already left Gath, Adullam, now he's at Mizpah. But he's only there for a short time, and he leaves again, and he goes to Masada. That's four places. But then the prophet says, no, don't stay here. Go back to Judah. And now we find him playing Robin Hood in a forest. He is five steps ahead of Saul, and Saul's sitting under a tree with a spear, and he doesn't even realize how far behind he is. I mean, David is moving and moving and moving and moving, and by the time the information gets to Saul, David's been moved four or five times. Why? Because God is directing his paths. One of the things that we need to realize is this. Let's not just jump to decisions. Let's let God direct our paths in the way he wants us to go. And so tonight, what do we see? We see that David, even when he was under intense pressure, was doing his sonly duty, trying to take care of aged parents. But then we see how that the presence of God in a person's life, and when God begins to direct and God begins to point in certain directions, how that you're always steps ahead of the evil one. Now next week, we're going to see Saul and his anger. He's going to begin to kill innocent people. And so I hope that maybe you'll read ahead next week as we go through the passage that follow us that we concluded tonight, okay? We'll pick up in probably verse 6 next Sunday night. Let's stand together. Thank you.